Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The shooting in Buffalo, New York this past weekend was racially motivated and left 10 people dead. 3 were injured. This is just the latest in a series of similar acts of violence in Charleston, Charlottesville, Pittsburgh, El Paso, Atlanta, to name a few. And all have the element of fear of the other. In Buffalo, the 18-year-old alleged perpetrator was consumed by something called replacement theory, which began as a white nationalist movement in the last century in Europe, but which has now spread virally in America. Here, it's the fear that non-white, non-Christian people and immigrants will replace whites. You heard white nationalists marching in Charlottesville chanting, "Jews will not replace us." Worse, this theory and other baseless claims are being pushed both overtly and covertly by some GOP leaders and pundits. That increases the anxiety, inflames the rage, ultimately ending, as we've seen, in violence. In today's world, and in a nation with freedom of speech, how do you tamp down on irrational conspiracy theories that lead to violence? What, if anything, can be done to avoid another of these senseless acts of violence? To help us sort this all out, we're joined by Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast and a frequent contributor to our weekly news roundup. Welcome back, Mary.
Thank you. Glad to be here, but not for this occasion.
Yeah, James Ford is with us too. He's executive director of the Center for Racial Equity in Education, or CRE. James, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And Dr. Shannon Reed is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice, specializing in white supremacy and gangs and other aspects of criminal violence at UNC Charlotte. Good morning and welcome back to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let me begin with a quick question and answer from each of you. White supremacy has been with us in this nation since the very beginning. In the mid-20th century, most white supremacists operated in the shadows. Who or what has given them permission to come out of the closet and operate in full view? Mary.
Well, they've always been there. And I think, you know, they haven't been as much in the shadows as you would say. And it's taken so many different forms. And I think now that people see from the census, when they hear that the country is becoming more black and brown. And I would say with the election of Barack Obama, which many people felt it really was, I think it broke some people's brains because that's not how they thought of America. And there are people who think of it as a zero sum proposition. Yeah. So as you see other people ascending and they say diversity is the strength, but people are pushing back on that they are looking and saying, this is not my America, but they have a very narrow definition and an incorrect one of what America is. Yeah. And I do think we have leaders who, if not encouraging them, are not renouncing it. They're not attacking this. They're not saying this is wrong. And that is giving people permission. And in some cases, they're even stoking it.
On the contrary, they're not only not saying this is wrong, they're saying this is right, either obliquely or absolutely saying the actual words. James, this may sound like a ridiculous question, but were we better off when these people were operating clandestinely, or are we better off knowing that they're there and we are seeing the impact that they are having when they unleash these irrational acts of violence?
You know, speaking from the perspective of a black person, we were neither better off or worse off when they were covert. I want to begin, if I may, by offering condolences to everybody who's been affected by the tragedy. You know, my dad is born and raised in East Buffalo, right? So, you know, I have an aunt who was headed to Tops, you know, right after the event happened. So I wanted to say that. But, you know, for Black folks, as she mentioned, like, this has been a cycle of what Dr. King called a white backlash. Whenever there's a modicum of racial progress, there is fear. There is absolute alarmist reactions. And, you know, white Americans in general have begun to fall apart and cry bloody murder. The world is collapsing, and it's followed by a period of fierce, violent backlash. And so it may go underground for a decade or so, and it might be reduced to mere rhetoric. But either way, whether it's overt or covert, Black folks and other folks of color, I presume, are being hurt. And so for me, you know, it's more disgusting because it's more out there. But I can't really say whether we're better or worse off, because at the end of the day, whether it be systemic or whether it be, you know, physically violent white supremacy, the outcome remains the same, in that Black folk and other folk of color end up getting hurt. And that's what's upsetting and enraging for me.
Shannon Reed, this 18-year-old alleged perpetrator in Buffalo went to a store in a predominantly Black neighborhood. He came there from another city in, and we'll talk about that later, another city in New York State. He subscribed to white replacement theory. He's posted about that on social media, and he wrote, I think, 180-page diatribe just prior to the attack. He's not alone in spreading this theory, and it goes way up the chain. Former U.S. Representative Steve King tweeted, "We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies." Tucker Carlson has complained more than, I think, 300 times on the air about this, saying that the Democratic Party is attempting to replace the current electorate with third world voters. Those are just a few of the latest iterations of a theory that's been with us for a while. Where did it come from and why?
So different iterations of this conspiracy theory have existed for a very long time. So we've seen versions of it in anti-Muslim countries. The one that we're speaking of now actually sort of came from a book by a French author, Camus, not the philosopher. And what he talked about was this idea, and it's not just, you know, the way we think about it in the general sense, the way sort of it's being processed is that white people are being replaced. But at the core of the conspiracy theory is that what matters is that you are changing the electoral base. And so you are, what's happening is the elites, whoever you think that is, everything from the Jewish population, the Illuminati, right, whatever group you think is trying, that truly controls the government, is trying to replace the voting power to take control of the government and be able to sort of control the population that way. So it's not just that the white population is being replaced by a minority population, which we see as part of the anti-immigration rhetoric, which is seen in now the abortion rhetoric. In that report, we saw them say, like, there aren't enough babies, right? So, and all of that is this idea that you are replacing the population, and especially the voting and the powerful population, with a non-white entity. And, but the core of it is, which I'm not sure that there's been no sense that this shooter or a lot of the people who act on this really understand, is that at the core of the conspiracy is that there is a political machination going on behind the scenes to basically control the population, which is why you hear that, like, the Jews will not replace us sort of rhetoric.
These theories, as pretty much really have, I remember the John Birch Society back in the 1960s, but for the most part, this stuff lurked in the background, in the shadows, because it was impolite, and the mass population really looked askance at some of these theories and some of the comments that are being made publicly right now. They were out in the open, being encouraged by, or promoted, in fact, by Republican politicians. Not all Republicans are involved in pushing this, but most are complicit in not calling it out. And yesterday, Republican Liz Cheney called on Republican leaders to, quote, renounce and reject white nationalists and those who hold those ideals close at heart, to heart. She added, the House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. How much of the blame for the increased ability to spew this venom, Mary, is due to the acquiescence or the cooperation of the GOP?
Well, I would not place blame on anyone for a murder, and they are all very outraged that people are making that connection.
Are they?
So there's that. So, no, I'm not going to say that. But I would say, you mentioned Liz Cheney. Well, what happened to her? She was replaced as the number three person in the House GOP leadership and replaced by Elise Stefanik of New York State, where this took place, who has been put on the carpet right now, and she's on the defensive because she's put out Facebook ads. They don't quite get as explicit mentioning this conspiracy theory as Shannon said, but they take a few of the edges off of it, but the essence is there. So you have to say the fact that now Kevin McCarthy, who is a House minority leader trying to be the majority leader, is cozying up to the folks like Stefanik and rejecting folks like Liz Cheney.
Yeah.
So the evidence is right there. And it's a drumbeat, and you see these code words that aren't really code, where Tucker Carlson, who the New York Times did a great piece on how he's doing this every night, talks about legacy Americans, and Newt Gingrich talks about classic Americans, where they mean white, right? And and you don't see the GOP censoring people like Paul Gosar, who put out that violent anime on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And you see this language all coming from, if you look at the primaries that are happening today up in Pennsylvania, the guy who might win the GOP nomination for governor is blatant about these things, about this being a white Christian. Well, he doesn't say white, but he is very heavily into this Christian country. And so I think the Republican Party, the fact that they are on the defensive right now, is proof that they have been, if not encouraging it, really enabling this, because they don't want to lose that base of voters. They have leaned in heavy. And this has been going on for a long time. Remember the Southern strategy. This is not something, Mike, when you say that, so many people said it was impolite. This has always been at the core. Even when civil rights laws were being passed, there was always that pushback, right? And you saw when the Democratic president was signing those laws, Lyndon Johnson, and said, we are writing off our party. Okay. He was right. And Republicans and Nixon and all those folks came in and said, come on over.
Let me get your take on this, James, because I know that you tweeted that the Republican lawmakers need to be asked more about their opinions on replacement theory. And when they are asked, you say they seem to dodge the question. What questions should specifically be asked and answers demanded for?
Yeah. Before I answer that, I want to say first that I want to be very clear. White supremacy is a bipartisan agenda. I think it's convenient to lay it completely at the feet of the GOP because overt white supremacists have found a safe haven. But I think that, the GOP has to ask the question. If you don't support great replacement theory, at the very least, right, your entire policy agenda, you have to ask why your party is 95%+ white. Right. And think critically about that. Is it that black and brown folks are just mindless sheep who are easily influenced into the Democratic Party? Or is it in a two-party system that they view your party platform in totality, Liz Cheney and all of those, beyond the isolated incident, as an affront to their existence? Right. Because that's really what we're talking about here, beyond sort of the most violent examples of white supremacy. It's a policy agenda that constricts the opportunities for folks of color. And for folks in the Democratic Party, I got smoke for them too. They need to do a better job of responding to the real needs and calling this stuff out in certain and not just in the closet.
James Ford, Executive Director for the Center for Racial Equity and Education. We will continue in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. We're talking about the shooting in Buffalo and the ramifications of that, the causes for it, and what can be done about it with Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast, James Ford, the executive director for the Center for Racial Equity and Education, and Dr. Shannon Reed, associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at UNC Charlotte. You wanted to follow up, Dr. Reed, on the point about the Democrats.
Actually, I was going to talk about mainstreaming. So if James would
I'm sorry. That was point. James. Excuse me. That's my fault. My mistake. No James, worries. You wanted to follow up.
Yeah, very, very, very briefly. I just wanted to say on the larger point about white supremacy operating at the systemic level. I mean, because that's the lens that, you know, that we use and we adopt, right, in the line of work that we do. We have to be, you know, honest about the fact that it's really not a partisan thing. And that's a lot of the framing around great replacement theory is about replacing an electorate and Black and brown folks voting Democrat. And the truth of the matter is Democrats have not been entirely attentive to the policy needs of Black and brown folk either. Right. In a lot of ways, they're pushed into the margin and attack the most socially conscious factions and flanks of their party to appeal to a white moderate base that they really don't have and has really never voted for them since the Civil Rights Act. And so in that same way, both folks are really operating in a degree of white supremacy that neglects the needs of, it's just one is a little more overt and a little more aggressive in this attack, and the other one is a little more neglectful. But I just wanted to make that point before moving on.
Go ahead.
And I just want to briefly say, James is dropping some really pearls of wisdom here, because as he noted, whites haven't really voted for a Democratic candidate for a very long time. Yet every election cycle, it's how can we get these, you know, working class white voters back, which I hate, you know, sort of that framing, because there are a lot of Black and brown working class folks. And so you see now that many Black voters are frustrated with the lack of police reform getting passed. Now it's more, you know, we're really backing the police, where it's a really nuanced debate. And voting rights, which we see have been really chipped away at in during the states, and they really wanted to get a push behind getting a national law, to a federal law to strengthen the Voting Rights Act. So there is that frustration there. So he's right. No party is really without blame here. But you really see the majority of African Americans voting for Democrats because they look at the choices. And when Republicans say, oh, you know, you're on the plantation, and it's like, oh, way to get Black voters, to accuse them of being mindless drones easily led by the Democratic Party. And they're just making choices based on, you know, who will hurt us the least.
Your specialty, Dr. Reed, is criminology. And I know there's probably a lot of blame that to go around, but it seems that most of the blame needs to go toward people who, whether you identify as a Republican or a Democrat, with people who allow these comments to be made or encourage these comments to be made that lead to violence and the perpetration of these conspiracy theories and replacement theory, etc. What happened in Buffalo on Sunday meets the definition of terrorism, domestic terrorism. And it seems to me that those who espouse the theories or support the theories or give credence to the theories that led to this violence are supporting domestic terrorists. Would that be beyond the pale to say?
It's definitely not beyond the pale to say, but I think, and I've argued this in my book about white power gangs, and what I wanted to say about the mainstreaming is that, you know, the political parties play a huge role in this, pundits play a huge role in this, but the reality is the most violent individuals in this, these groups, are probably not watching Tucker Carlson, right? They're 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. So while we're seeing the influence of these, you know, larger systemic, you know, sort of issues filtering through, the reality is the recruitment and or radicalization, and I say that very loosely because in all honesty, most of the youth involved with these groups don't truly understand the conspiracy theories or what they're standing for. I had a youth once tell me, who was part of a Peckerwood gang, that when he hung out with his friends, they did Hitler, right? Sorry, I can't swear, Hitler stuff. and so, you know, they don't really understand, right? They're not here to really overthrow the system. they're here and they're part of this because it gives them power that they feel like they don't have. And it gives them a sense of individuality. So as you're online, as these youth are online, and like even the 180 page manifesto, a lot of that was lifted from different Reddit posts. You know, it's not an original document for the most part. He is pulling it from different places and different talking points. And so what you're seeing is that the adoption of these white power signs and symbols are used in a way to inspire fear and inspire, you know, power for youth who maybe feel like they are powerless and they get accolades for doing these things. Yeah. So while the act itself is a terrorist act, the comparison of them to, say, a group like ISIS overestimates our ability to intervene with these individuals.
You're disagreeing, James. I can see it in your face.
And I want to respect, you know, the area of scholarship is not, you know, my area of expertise, but I do disagree. I think that there's a way we infantilize white folks than we do that we don't with Black folks, right? They're children who don't understand. You know, I remember reading Dylann Roof's manifesto, and it was a very sophisticated document with very well articulated arguments.
He's the Charleston shooter.
This feels like Dylann Roof 2.0 in a lot of ways, you know, traveling cross country, targeting a majority Black zip code, understanding the significance of it. And you know, we ought not relegate these acts of terrorism to mere boys and women. Like, you know, if you look at like the Birmingham bombings, right? There was a whole network, a terrorist cell. We don't use that language in a lot of that. I feel like, again, is predicated on white supremacy. We are all about the technicalities when it comes to that, but ISIS, we have no problem saying that they're terrorists. In fact, they've been around longer than ISIS. The tradition of anti-Black terror is at the foundation. And so to look at this purely through like the adolescent lens and those who are involved and to forget that these were men who blew up four little girls in Birmingham, right? They knew what they were doing. It emanates from the same root. And she's right in saying that most of it may not come from online sources, but it comes from the family. You know, white supremacy and hatred is passed down like old recipes and family heirlooms. You know, it's not going to go away because you have a younger generation of folks.
For sure. Yeah, I was definitely not trying to say, I think my point was not that we should, you know, sort of excuse the behavior of white individuals because, you know, they aren't as smart or whatever. Really what I'm trying to say is when we see Black or brown gang youth and who commit crimes, we look at them and we see criminals and we see somebody who needs to be locked up. When we look at white youth who do very similar things or the same things, but also are sort of carrying this white power rhetoric around with them, we look at them, or law enforcement especially looks at them and says, oh, these are youth, you know, it's a phase, it's a fad, it's, you know, it's something, that's why they're not showing up in gang databases, right? Even though they're committing the same crimes, they're in the same age range, they, you know, so to me it's more like when we put the terrorist label on it, what my concern is that is it pushes it away from a local level. So if I say, oh, we have a terrorist cell, then a local CMPD is gonna say, well, we don't deal with terrorists, right? That's an FBI problem. But the reality is there are youth in this city who need to be intervened upon now, and it is a CMPD problem. And so I guess my concern with the label is that it just pushes the responsibility away from the local community. Because they're just going to say, oh, well, that's not what we do. We deal with gangs, we deal with local violence. And a lot of this violence is local. A lot of this danger is local. And so that's my concern with the terrorist label. Not that I disagree with the fact that what they are doing is very terroristic, but rather that it keeps pushing the ball down the line about whose problem it is.
And Mary, I know you want to jump in here.
Oh, of course I do. I do think that, you know, I'll put some numbers here. The FBI, Department of Homeland Security, all say that our number one domestic terrorism problem in the United States is anti-Black, white supremacist in nature. And the media, you know, my own media, we need to do a much better job because you did see initial reports lean into this. Saw him, this 18-year-old teen, you know, teenager, kid, mental illness, all of these things. And I was talking to my husband. I said, you know, there are many people who have mental illness problems and they're dealing with them. They don't go out and shoot a whole bunch of Black people in a market. I think we should retire this lone wolf. This guy's screed, I refuse to call it a manifesto, it makes it sound like it's important, was lifted from Christ Church in New Zealand, where that terrorist went to a mosque. We saw the man in El Paso drive to where there were Mexican Americans. They are all together, they're online, and some of the same people who are trying to soft pedal some of this are the same people who go to school board meetings and scream because they don't want their kids learning about the history of race in this country and systemic racism that causes these problems. So they go on the internet and they see these half-cracked conspiracies, and it makes them feel important, as Shannon said, where if they learned about where this came from, why it is, it's not to make people feel guilty, it's just to make them become informed about their country. And the joke of saying a legacy American, how about the Native Americans, you know? African Americans been here hundreds of years. And some of these same Congress people, you know, whose ancestors are immigrants that came here in this century or the last, are saying that they are the legacy Americans. This whole debate is just, it's so frustrating.
We talked yesterday on a different program on a slightly different topic about code words, the use of code words and how politicians have become adept at using them, and that there's a whole subset of the population who hears and understands what those code words really mean, while others seem to be oblivious to it. And I asked the question, well, you know, if these code words work, why did we spend 5 years, many of us, scratching our heads over trying to figure out what Donald Trump was all about? So let me ask a direct question. Is that what is meant by make America great again? Is it make America white again?
Well, you can look at the again to go back to a time when women were, when minorities were, when, you know, this is it. And you could see it even in some of the language in the draft opinion for Samuel Alito, Associate Justice, talking about that. There is this movement. And one third, according to an AP poll, one third of the American people believe in some sort of truth, in part, in this great replacement conspiracy theory, and nearly half of Republicans. Okay, so they do want to go back to a time that what had certain groups on top, because rather than work hard and compete in an increasingly diverse society, they want to go back to a status quo where the lines, where everyone knew his or her place.
And if you can massage the truth or not teach the truth, then no one really knows what the real truth is. And you wrote a column, James Ford, in 2021, in which you wrote about the toxic racial theory that's poisoning the country. You talked about Steve King, though I think we've already quoted. You also quoted the Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who was then running his gubernatorial campaign in 2019, saying that no other nation has ever survived the diversity and multiculturalism that America faces today. That's a very loud dog whistle. As a teacher of world history, which you are, is it true that no other nation has ever survived the diversity and multiculturalism that America faces today? And if so, is that because no other nation has ever experienced it? And although we are experienced it, is that what ails us?
Absolutely not. And what an ahistorical, unserious take that is, right? And it's only put out there to activate and prime white people's racial anxieties, right? It's about scaring white people. Right. And like, that's what these folks specialize in. Every election is like scaring white folk. We should note here, when we talk about like replacement, that on a global scale, I don't know if a lot of people know this, white people are already numeric minority. Like, I think the number is like folks of color outnumber white folk globally around 11 or 12 to one. Right. So let's be clear about that. Right. The world is not majority white. But in nations that have been settled by white European folks, we're talking about the West, Europe, Australia, United States, the feeling that other folks coming in and eventually rising to a numerical majority creates a fear of loss of dominance. And so not just political power, but culturally, the ways we talk, the ways we eat, the things that we learn. And so somebody must do something to combat against that is essentially what they're saying there. And so, and that's really what has precipitated the onset of this, what's called minority rule.
Yeah.
This is why they are shrinking the electorate. They're gerrymandering because they have to create a scenario where power is consolidated into the hands of a very small and shrinking minority, despite the fact that numerical majority now outweighs and has the potential political power to change and dictate the direction of the country. And so this is about just, you know, screaming bloody murder, crying, you know, falling apart at the seams, becoming unglued, and they have mastered that ability to do that.
And casting themselves as victims. This is interesting. This is all, you know, and Donald Trump really leaned into that really successfully. Look what they're doing to you. They're discriminating against you. You are the victims. And in a sense, what James brought up was really great because it was saying not just politically, but they already feel like they've lost the culture, you know, in music and art and, you know, same-sex marriage and Black people who are vice presidents. And so they feel they've lost that. So this is it. And I also don't want to really excuse religion because we've seen the rise of white Christian nationalism. And I did write a column for Roll Call. When you feel that God is on your side, then anything is acceptable for you to do. And the language you hear in some churches is not about God. It's about the other people are evil. And you can go, and if we lose these elections, we will lose ourselves. And if the other person is evil, then they're not humans. And we saw what happened in Buffalo. These were human beings, wonderful people. Please read their stories. Don't lose that. But if you think someone's not human, then you can just shoot them down.
Dr. Reed.
So two quick things. One, I totally agree about the point of religion. The Christian identity movement that has sort of been growing is hugely impactful in that overlap between religion and white supremacy. And second, I really want to focus on the value of schools in education and fighting this battle. So we know there's been that huge uproar about critical race theory, which no one who is against it even understands the concept of what it is. But when you look at early, so I'm gonna talk about racist skinheads, early racist skinhead rhetoric from even the 80s, you know, what they'll say is, don't you think it's unfair that there's a Black student union and not a white student union? Don't you think it's unfair that there's a Black History Month and not a White History Month? And when you have young people who have not had the critical thinking skills necessary to sort of process that there is a reason that those, you know, groups exist and that those groups are there for a very important reason, then you can't fight this problem.
And with that, we have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're here with James Ford, Executive Director of the Center for Racial Equity and Education, Mary Curtis with Roll Call, and Dr. Shannon Reed with UNC Charlotte, who specializes in criminal justice, criminology, gangs, and white supremacy. You can't stop people from thinking the thoughts that they think. And in this country, we have the added freedom of speech, which makes it difficult, it seems, to patrol or control a lot of this. People can state opinions. And Mary, you write a column that people can agree with or disagree with vehemently. That's our right as Americans. How can we possibly control the kind of free speech that goes on the dark web and on these online platforms or on Fox News, for that matter, or out of the mouths of politicians that inflame certain elements in our society to the point where they're willing to go out and commit these acts of violence? Are we helpless in the face of that, given the Constitution?
Well, we do seem like we're pushing against the tide. And a lot of that is because people get their information in silos where they will only go to one particular source. So what they're hearing is reinforcing what they already believe. And that's a problem. But all of these organizations have standards and practices, you know, and that is kind of interesting because you see these social media companies that say, okay, we're private businesses, we're not really media, so we're not really subject to some of the same rules that you are about truth and fact. We can just put it all out there. And you do have fact checkers that are trying to keep up with it, but there's such a flood of disinformation that it's really difficult to hold on to it. And then we have folks like, you know, Elon Musk has said that if he, comes back and he gets Twitter, that he's going to let Donald Trump come back on, that he is going to allow more freedom of speech, which means a lot of rhetoric that is untrue to be on there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so I think that is something we're going to have to face because we did not have these kind of social media platforms and people don't quite know how to deal with them. You know, are they companies? Are they media? You know,
In the aftermath of Buffalo, the governor of New York criticized social media, saying that those who provide these platforms have a moral and ethical, and I hope to have a legal responsibility to ensure that such hate cannot populate these sites, because this is the result. You know, licensed broadcast television and radio stations that broadcast over the air have a set of rules under which we operate and cannot be violated or you lose your license to broadcast. They'll pull it and you have to go off the air or they'll give it to another company. This is not the case with cable news. This is not the case with social media. Should it be? Doctor.
So it's an interesting conundrum, right? So a lot of people are not sure if social media is a negative or a positive when we look at it as a whole. But I think the battling social media is probably going to be a bit of a losing battle, because even if we go back to pre what we think of social media now, there were still old school phone-in message boards where you could post this rhetoric and get information. They were pamphleting. I mean, we've even seen recently the KKK pamphleting, these different groups, the identity groups being on campuses. And so, you know, social media certainly plays a role in the fact of how quickly people can get it and how easily they can fall into those echo chambers that Mary was talking about, where they're just sort of listening to the same thing over and over again. But the really difficult problem we have is the critical thinking issue, right? There has been an attack on facts. There has been an attack on critical thinking. If you go back to some of the conversations that we've seen with, you know, Newt Gingrich looking at the FBI statistics, saying, you know, that they're not true, right? Or that we can interpret them however we want, but they're statistics, right? So the idea that feelings are the same as facts is really difficult to overcome. And so we really need to have people think critically about what they're reading online, where it's coming from, and not just have a knee-jerk reaction that what they're reading is truth.
James, following all of these acts of violence, whether they're racially motivated or not, we always hear about thoughts and prayers for the victims and their families. And we hear about how this isn't America. Well, this is America, and thoughts and prayers may comfort some, but they don't do a lot to stop future acts of violence. If anything good came from this, would it be that it will result in some people toning down their hateful rhetoric, at least for a while? Or do you think people will simply double down on that rhetoric because, look, it's working?
So first of all, you took the words out of my mouth. I'm so happy you said that, right? That is exactly what we default to. The only thing I'd add is that we call for unity, right? In the wake of these things. And it's like, I'm not unifying with folks who, you know, would do such a thing or would endorse such a thing. If there's anything that's good that came out of it, it's hard for me to say that, but it's that I hope folks see that this whole thing that Dr. Reed mentioned in terms of the assault against supposed critical race theory, which was really a ruse to sort of dethrone and dismantle any attempt to address racism, it was really a projection. And that is the consistent pattern, right? You're accusing folks of promoting a divisive racial theory when in fact that's what you're doing. You're accusing folks of engaging in election fraud and when in fact that's what you're doing. You're accusing folks of grooming young people, but you won't raise the age for marriage. You know, that's the pattern here. And if nothing else, I'm hopeful that people can begin to see that and become more full-throated, because my fear is that, unfortunately, as a historical thinker, we have never truly held particularly violent white racists accountable for anything. Right. That includes the Civil War, right? We allowed folks 10%, so 1 out of 10 folk, to renounce their allegiance to the Confederacy in order to be readmitted into the Union. That is a slap on the wrist, and it sets the stage for the South will rise again, white supremacist sort of rhetoric. I need President Biden, I need everyone else who is in the highest in the legislature and in the highest forms of government to actually do something, right? Yeah. And to rid white supremacists from the various military ranks, from the police ranks, to actually do something about these folk who we know have proliferated throughout institutions all over the country. And so that's what I want to see beyond thoughts and prayers and calls for unity. I want accountability. I don't care about right. unity.
I want to say what James says is totally correct. And another one of those phrases, as you said, Mike, is this is not who we are. This is exactly who we are, you know, and we would know this if we were taught our history. After Reconstruction, after the Civil War, when Black folks were voting and being, you know, getting to higher office, there was a bloody, violent pushback. As my son, the historian, always tells me, with progress always comes pushback, and ushered in decades of violence and lynching and Jim Crow. So we have to face that. And what can we do? I think the American people have a lot of responsibility. If 1/3 of the public believes in these crackpot theories and that, you know, if anything someone else gets takes away from me, that means 2/3 don't. So what are you going to do? Are you going to vote? Are you going to, what are you going to do with them?
In our country, we seem to be fixated on race. Similar problems result from other fixations around the globe. This is not a uniquely American situation. It is a global problem, although ours is focused on our original sin. James, you spent a lot of time in a classroom. You were North Carolina Teacher of the Year. You taught world history at Geringer High School. And there are people who say we don't teach history and we don't teach civics to kids anymore. How are we dealing with these topics, what we've been talking about today in the classroom? What are students learning about racism, about hate groups, about the impact of hate speech on the tide of history?
What are they learning now versus what are they probably set up to learn is two different things. What they're learning now, there are a lot of teachers who are confronting this and teaching this thematic thing. You're right. It's part of the human condition to find areas of difference and to use those to predicate certain societal privileges on, right? Ethnic groups, religious affiliation, sexual identity orientation. But we're not teaching these things. We are essentially trying to play down our differences and minimize things in such a way that we only talk about the good parts. And we don't really investigate the negative parts or the parts that have brought about the worst parts of history, because I think keeping a population docile and ignorant is profitable for those who are in power. And so, unfortunately, most folk, most adults, not just children, have not had the opportunity to think very deeply about this and are ignorant of our historical past, both as a nation and as a globe, about the ways that these things reanimate themselves and just reoccur over and over and over again in different societies, time periods, epochs, people groups. But it's the same story every single time. And we got to find a way to get ahead of the curve. That's the point of history.
And I think we saw this really reflected in the Confederate statue issues, you know, where that history people want to keep and, you know, like, remember, and that's important. But when you have people like Bryan Stevenson saying we should have lynching memorials where people, you know, that, but that's not the history we want to see. So, you know, I think that is a good example of sort of how, like James said, we are trying to keep the unity part of history and dismiss the really negative parts of history in ways that, not that other countries do it perfectly, but certainly we can see from Germany that they have, you know, really tried to be much more thoughtful and careful about how they teach their history and make sure that those museums are open and, you know, to prevent, not that Germany does not have a Nazi problem. They do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there's at least an ownership there that we are not seeing here.
How big is, you study gangs and white supremacy, Dr. Reed. How big is the problem? Are they everywhere, or is it just a tiny amount of people who have a stunning amount of impact?
Oh, no, they're everywhere. Because, you know, just like the vast majority of gang members, you know, there are a lot of gang members who do very little. And there are a small number of gang members who commit very serious violent acts. And the white supremacist gangs are no different. So we've seen groups like Adam Waffen Division who have had huge, you know, press. A lot of their crimes are drug dealing, killing roommates, right? They aren't hate crimes. He thought his roommate was a lizard person, but that's a different story. So, you know, they are doing what we think are not normal crimes, but standard crimes, not very high level
crimes. The crime in Buffalo has been classified as a hate crime. What does that mean?
And it should be.
And what does it mean?
To gang research or to the general public?
To law enforcement.
Oh, nothing. It doesn't mean anything to them. Our hate crime statistics are terrible in this country. So really all the hate crime designation does, if you can prove it in a court of law, is change this potential sentence. But it's going to be a homicide sentence anyways. So it's more of a tack on to a crime versus...
Is this a local law enforcement situation or is it a national law enforcement situation? And are either of our law enforcement mechanisms equipped to deal with what we're facing here?
So I would say it's a local law enforcement issue because this is where these youth are coming from. And this is the local police are the ones who are going to have the early contact with these individuals.
But terrorism is a federal crime. It's not a local crime. It's not even recognized locally.
And that's my concern, right? So there were a number of risk factors that this youth displayed that should have been picked up by local groups, whether it's his school, whether it's law enforcement locally, before it escalated to a terrorist issue. So we are missing the forest for the trees. We are going after the high profile people and missing the others who are active in our communities, who are disrupting local communities and waiting for the rarer and more violent events.
The tide that seems to be sweeping across America right now among some is being driven by social media. It's been driven by politicians. It's being driven by very powerful forces in the media. Make no mistake, Fox News is a very powerful force. Mary, in the face of that, how do you reverse the buildup of hatred and suspicion of the other that is based fundamentally in paranoia?
Well, you know, we have to come to a realization that it's this serious. You know, Dame said it's profitable to teach history in a certain way, and Shannon has talked about that too, but it's also dangerous. And we've seen how these politicians and others have leaned into it because they feel it would be profitable for them, but then they can't control it. You can't unleash that. I mean, if Trump went away tomorrow, Trumpism would still be there. And it is, like, as I said, if you feel that the enemy is, your opponent is existentially an evil enemy, then eliminating that person seems very reasonable. So we are going to really have to really try to put democracy front and center on the ballot and realize that we are going to move forward together or sink.
Both sides see this as existential, at least the leadership does as existential, but I don't think that the population necessarily sees it that way. We saw, James, what happened to Charlotte Mecklenburg schools when busing to achieve integration was dropped. The court order was dropped. We reintegrated the schools. Is that to say, and I have 30 seconds, is that to say that if we dropped all of our civil rights legislation, that we would revert back to the America of the 18th century, 19th century?
I think history tells us that that's the intention and that's the outlook, is that we want to run a roll back the clock. My hope is that there's an activated base of folks who stand in the way of that. But I think it's incredibly dangerous to assume that there's some moral force that this is going to keep America in business. Empires fall all the time, and we may be on the precipice of that.
James Ford, Executive Director of the Center for Racial Equity in Education, Mary C. Curtis, the columnist for RollCall.com and the host of their Equal Time podcast, and Dr. Shannon Reed, Associate Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.